This is a Pinball News production.
So in case I forget to tell you guys this, after this session, Dennis and Greg are going to be over in the signing area, and they'll sign all of your anything you want signed. So
almost anything.
All right, so we're going to start with a couple of questions, and then they have a presentation for you guys.
How y'all doing?
Glad to be here. And where are we this week?
Atlanta.
All right, so first of all, is the show treating you guys right?
Absolutely.
We're having a great time.
You guys do it upright, that's for sure.
Well, we tried to give out a little of that Southern hospitality, and we really hope that comes across. So let's go back to the beginning. I'm going to ask a couple of questions, then we'll do your slideshow. But I wanted to give some background on you guys. Did you guys grow up with a passion for pinball or around pinball? Tell us about your roots in this.
You want to start?
The first pinball memory I have, I was about 7 or 8 years old, so that was a hell of a long time ago. But one of my father's friends had a pinball machine, and I was just, it's the first time I ever saw one. I thought that was the coolest thing I ever saw. Of course, it was an old wood rail back in those days, but I just remember thinking I just liked all the colors and the lights. But then I kind of lost track of pinball till I was about 21 or 22, and that's when I started playing again.
Great. What about you, Greg?
In the Chicago area, that's where I grew up, pinball was manufactured there. All the major manufacturers were always in the Chicago area. But for me, growing up, I really didn't see pinball very much because it was kind of illegal in the Chicago metropolitan area. So my first memories of pinball or pinball-like devices were the pitch and bat games. I'd be on vacation in Wisconsin with my family, and you know, my parents would go into a bar or something, and there'd be these cool, you know, things with lights flashing and stuff, and I'd be like, "Dad, quarters, please," you know, or whatever, dimes probably back then, and I'd go play pitch and bats, you know, while they had a good time. And I had a good time playing the pitch and bats. So, and like Dennis, it wasn't until I got into college where I moved away from the Chicago area in 1972 and got to see pinball firsthand in locations and played them for the first time. And I remember playing a wizard, you know, and I was like, wow, this is cool. And, oh, look, Dave Christensen signed it. Who's that guy, you know? And it was just so cool to see pinball in the wild. And then, you know, just a few short years later, I started in the business.
Great. Yeah. So I have an individual question for each of you guys. Start with Dennis. One more for you. So in college, you had kind of an epiphany about the design of pinball cabinets. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I went back to college when I was about 30 because I was in data processing and I hated it because I was always creative. So I went back when I was about 30 and majored in industrial design and specifically product design. And in our senior year, they let us pick a project that we wanted to do. So I decided I wanted to design a more modern, futuristic pinball cabinet. And so I did that, and I got an A on the project. And then I had to have back surgery, so I couldn't take my courses again for another year. So during the summer when I was recovering, I built a full-size version of that cabinet, and I took it to Schaefer Distributing in Columbus. They suggested that I go to Bally because Chuck Farmer, at the time, was the president of the Bally Pinball Division, and he had formerly been the president of Schaefer Distributing. So I had an Ohio contact at Bally, and I took the game to Bally, and they hired me.
And Bally was really y'all's first interaction with each other, right?
Yeah,
right.
We graduated from Bally High.
So you guys have any funny stories from the early days at Bally?
No, there's no stories.
Come on.
None that we can tell, anyway.
Yeah, especially back then.
Nothing?
When I got there, I was just a boy from Ohio, and went to the first trade show.
Very and tall I was like, boy.
So we went to the first trade show, and I was just, I'd never been to anything like that before. At the party after the show was amazing. There was a full orchestra. There was lamb chop hors d'oeuvres all around.
They had shrimp bigger than my thumb.
So I was, yeah, I was in a different world.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's when I met my wife too. When I started at Bally, she was Chuck Farmer's secretary, and
that is the sweet story of Bally. It's that most of us that work there, we met our spouses at work, and you know, the rest is history. We've been happily married for, you know, forever, and it's all good. You know, Bally was a great meeting place for a lot of people.
A little pinball love connection.
Absolutely.
Well. So, Greg, one last question for you guys, then we'll get to the show. So it seems like we know a lot about how artwork and the artwork for games is designed nowadays, but you didn't have all those tools back in the day. Give us a little behind the curtain on how did you make artwork back in the day for these games?
That's a great question. Yeah, before computers, BC, you know, there was tools like paintbrushes and you know, pencils and airbrushes and it was like it's definitely a different world today, and maybe sometimes for the better and sometimes not. But when I think back on it, it was a painstaking process because it was all in the real world, in real time. And when you made a mistake, it was hard to fix. So we would start with pencil sketches, usually thumbnails, very small, rough, just to get my ideas down on paper quickly. If I showed it to somebody, I'd have to navigate, well, this is going to be this. It doesn't look like that now, but, you know, and this over here, that's that guy. He's going to have a sword, you know, or whatever the case may be. And then once I felt comfortable, I would work that up into a larger, a tighter sketch, used reams of tracing paper to continuously refine the sketch and make it better, and then finally get to a layout for a back glass. Once the back glass was established, then I'd start designing the cabinet graphics, and the playfield would come along for the ride. And playfields were a different animal completely. Literally pen and ink to create what we call the key line, and then everything else was hand-cut from a substance called rubylith, and we would cut the art that we wanted to print, and we would peel off the art that we didn't want to print.
Wow.
And each color was a separate color, and it was mind-blowing, time-consuming, and very difficult. But when I think back on it fondly, so
well, that's,
you know,
good.
It's all cool.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of work.
Designing playfields was similar. When I started, we had pencils, and we had a T-square and triangles. And if you wanted to make a change, it was at least we had the invention of the electric eraser. That was a wonderful thing. But it was to change a post or a rail or anything was a big hassle. Now, what I'm using is still an antique AutoCAD. I don't use SolidWorks yet, but it lets you try so many different things so much faster.
Yeah. Well, you guys have collaborated on so many great games, but we are focused on your latest creation, the spectacular Wonelli, Big Juicy Melons. And I'm going to let you take this over with the video, because
sure.
Any questions I would have would be answered by this video. So, Brian, you want to go ahead and...
We're going to show you from how we started and why we started on this project, and we're gonna get it from start to finish. From the garage all the way to the Stern shop. So a lot of people ask, you know, so how did you develop this whiz-bang style? And, well, it's years of working together. You know, Dennis and I, like Patrick said, we've been working together since about the early 80s on games, on ideas, and we just we mesh well together. We both have a similar knucklehead approach to game design, and we like people to have fun, and not fun in a serious, you know, way. We want to make people laugh if possible, and so we just kind of put our brains together, and the rest comes out.
And we almost get a whole brain out of that.
Yeah, we almost get a whole. That's right. So anyway, in talking about brains, that is a device that I had to build for a game called Strange Science, so that I would have some semblance of what that brain transfer device was going to look like on the playfield. And that guy over there, that's called a funny picture. All of these are called funny pictures because we used Polaroid cameras. Anybody ever know what a Polaroid camera is? Yeah, there you go. So we'd use Polaroid shots to take quick pictures to help us develop, you know, the sketches and stuff like that. So we amassed, like, stacks of funny pictures. And when you see them out of context, they're pretty strange. But anyway, next slide, please.
Well, this is for the back glass of Elvira and the Party Monsters.
Oh, that's true. That's true. So we like working in pairs. You know, Elvira was a natural pair of games. Wait, what? What are you laughing about? Anyway, so, you know, we working with Cassandra was amazing. We have a great relationship with her, and she trusts what we do amazingly, and so she was a great person to work with. I can't say enough about her. Next slide. So before I met this guy, you know, he was still in Ohio, and I got an early start to my career. I was a punk. I was 23 years old when I got the job at Bally. And the Harlem Globetrotters was my first game that I ever worked on, and it was amazing to be in house and doing illustration all day long. I couldn't have been more amazed that I got this job. So Harlem Globetrotters was the first project I worked on, probably the most famous game that I've worked on from the pinball collecting community is Fathom. I get lots of kudos. Every time I come to a show that, wow, Fathom is so beautiful, you know. And I'm glad to hear that. It's really heartening. And I'll tell you what, Paul Ferris, my art director at the time, the guy that hired me at Bally, pushed me hard to get the best job I could get on this. So I always give Paul a lot of credit because he really, really leaned on me hard to make sure that I was doing the best I could on that project. I think he may have wanted to do it, but was busy doing other projects. So I think he really forced my hand to do the best job I could at the time. So I'm always appreciative of Paul for that reason. Next slide, please. After we've met, I also got to work with other game designers like Steve Ritchie. The best thing I can say about Steve is he is persistent. He gets what he wants. He pushes his people hard as well, and for good reasons. You know, he's got great games in the field, and we all know and love his product. It's a completely different style than Dennis's games, but you know, to each his own. Every designer has their own unique kind of fingerprint of style in their games. So. The amazing thing with Steve was he knew I had worked on funny games with you know, other designers, and so he said, yeah, that stuff you do with Nordman, you're not doing that if you work with me. He goes,
no,
I don't
funny
want
stuff.
I don't want any funny stuff going on. And I said, well, okay. And he said, so we're working on Star Trek Next Generation. I said, perfect. That's not funny at all. So so we had a great time on that project. We got a lot of cooperation from Paramount and all the talent that came with the show. So I couldn't be more proud of that game and you know, what it's the mark that it's left on the everlasting pinball community. Next slide, please. And we got to work together again on No Fear. No Fear was me saying to Steve, okay, now that we did that really serious thing, let's do something that's a little more fun and a little more lighthearted, in your style, of course. So No Fear seemed to be the natural you know, connection with Steve. Everything fast, everything furious, and we got to put a little wackiness in there too. So I was appreciative of Steve to let me have a little bit of say in the fun factor of the game. So next one. And then Revenge from Mars. Thanks. I ended my pinball career with this game. Well, my previous pinball career. This was the end of the line for pinball at Williams. Sadly to say, we really worked hard on the Pinball 2000, you know, platform, and we really thought that it could be the thing that would bridge pinball and video game players to a point where, you know, it was a great marriage, we thought. Now, the behind-the-scenes story on this backlash, you'll see an Edsel in the lower left. So the story behind that is, because there's every time we do unlicensed stuff, there's a story behind everything in the artwork. So the Edsel. So I'm walking down the hall while we're working our butts off trying to get this game done, and I hear our CEO, Neil Nicastro, talking to a big distributor in one of the rooms in engineering where the game was set up to play. It was still early in development. And I overhear him telling him, yeah, we don't know how good this thing's going to be. It might be the next Edsel. Who knows? I was like, are you kidding me? That's how you feel about this? So I made sure to get the Edsel in the back glass so that it would be everlasting. So... Next. So now it's time for Dennis to talk.
So this is the cabinet on the right is the model that I made in college. That's a quarter scale model. And it had a lot of interesting features that current games didn't have. The one thing that I realized, if you look at the game, if you look at the picture on the left and the game on the right, at that time, the score displays were just stuck all over the back glass, and I figured it was hard for players to reference their scores when they were playing. So the idea in this game is that vertical black area would have been where all your scores were, so you could easily reference it while you were playing. And all games have that today. And then just above that area, that ridged area, is where I put the speakers, reasoning that you could hear the sound so much better in arcade if the speakers pointed towards the player instead of at the ground like all games at the time did. Greg didn't like it because I put a small back box on it. But that was for styling reasons. So I built the quarter scale model out of plexiglass and acrylic and different stuff. Later on when I was at Williams, I stuck the Demolition Man stuff on there just to decorate it a little bit. So the one on the left is the full size one that I built and took to Schaefer Distributing. And that's what led to my interview at Bally and got me my first job.
Next.
And then, so I took my cabinet to Bally. I got hired to do cabinet design, and I did. So they used my cabinet, similar to the one that I designed. They used it for Rapid Fire. And since Rapid Fire didn't do very well, they had a lot of cabinets left over, so they made 8-Ball Deluxe Limited Edition using the same cabinet.
It's here.
Is it?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet. So then a year after that, I got laid off. That's the story of my career. I've been laid off 4 or 5 times. I don't know what's wrong with me. But
bad timing, that's all.
Yeah, so... Also, I went to Gottlieb for a while, and that became Milestar, but my claim to fame there was that I designed the Us Versus Them Laserdisc game, worked with Warren Davis, who did Qbert, and Jeff Lee, who also did the art for Qbert, and got laid off from there when Coca-Cola bought them. So I fumbled around for a while and thought I really wanted to design a pinball game. So at that time, Rambo was real popular. So I went down to the recruiting office and got a bunch of Ranger and Special Force brochures and glued it all up and made a little story and took it to Bally and got hired again. And and Special Force was my first game, my first pinball game then.
Yep. And then you went on, did like other cool stuff like Demolition Man and Whitewater.
Yeah. And, Blackwater 100.
Blackwater. Yeah, Blackwater, Whitewater, you know.
Next one's going to be dishwater.
Yeah. So, little real quick licensing story. So, three equal size heads because of lawyers. Anyway, next slide.
And so, I guess there was probably no other layoffs. No, I went to IGT and I designed slot machines for a while. And I got a call from Stern asking me if I'd like to come back and design pinball games again. And I jumped at the chance because I'm not really interested in gambling, and pinball to me is a lot more fun than slot machines. So this was my first game after 5 or 6 years, so I was thrilled to have the opportunity to do this again.
One of the coolest toys on a playfield, the sinking ship.
That's what I've heard. Also, there's a story we wanted to use Jack the Monkey in the game. That one shot is like called the Jack the Monkey shot, and we found out Jack the Monkey had his own agent. And Jack the Monkey wanted to be paid extra for being on the game. But they finally relented and let me put Jack the Monkey in the game.
Did he do voiceover work?
No, he didn't do any voiceover. No monkey business.
Okay.
And they're all... Thank you. I wanted to put some of the stuff from the parks in the game. Those are two completely different entities, and they wouldn't allow me to do anything from the Pirates of the Caribbean attraction, and they wanted no hidden Mickeys or anything like that in the game.
Oh, God. You're not going to tell us. Disney World right now. You know?
I can't tell you that there might be a hidden Mickey in the game somewhere.
All right, next slide. Thank you. So, yeah, this is where we started combining our knucklehead wackiness together. I had proposed a game to a guy named Greg Hamick, who is also another great game designer. And he had a game called DEFCON 6, which was a little too serious, I thought, for pinball. So I said, hey, there's enough lights on here where we could spell out party, you know. And he's like, what are you getting at? I said, well, what if we did a party theme game, you know, with like animals and stuff, you know, having parties, you know, just kind of cool stuff. Pat McMahon could do a really good job on the back glass.
This is when the phrase party animal was real
popular.
It was
hip back then, yeah. So he said, no, thanks, I don't want to do a party game. Well, he was in the engineering lab at the time, and he said, well, I'll do it. So we started putting our heads together on this game, and Pat did a great job, we thought, on the back glass and playfield art, and it was just a lot of fun to work with. So it kind of launched our career together, even though I didn't do the art package per se, but I had a lot of influence in, you know, what the game should feel like and all that kind of good stuff. So it was fun to work together to get that going.
This was the hardest game for me to design because this was my second game. I used up all my good ideas on my first game. So it was tough, but then once I got through this game, then it became a lot easier to find new ideas from somewhere.
I think musicians have a similar thing. They put out a hit album, and then they say, wow, we got to do another one, and it's got to be a hit. So anyway, next slide, please. So then our wackiness continued once we got
your wackiness.
Well. We got to Williams after Bally got sold in '88, and so we started pitching this game called Dr. Dude. He wanted to do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles license, and I at the time was just like, you know, that could be cool, but why don't we do our own comic book and put a comic book on the back glass and tell a story and, you know, come up with our own story. And, you know, so we actually did Elvira first, but we started working on this first.
I started this playfield first and created the Mixmaster feature, and none of the management people liked it for some reason.
Yeah.
And so then the Elvira license became available, so we jumped on that. And revisited this later.
Right. We worked with Elvira, and we got that off the ground. And one of the best things to happen, you know, to us
is pinball got best new equipment. It was voted best new equipment at the AMOA show that year, and we were just ecstatic that pinball had finally come back and won best new equipment. So that
hadn't happened in like 10 years.
Yeah, that was awesome. So the video game craze was, you know, hopefully starting to subside, and pinball was again being recognized. So that was very cool. We were real happy with that. The funny thing, and my great story here is Steve Kordick, you know, love the guy. You know, he was our mentor. He was our pinball dad, everybody's pinball dad. And we pitched this to a group of people in engineering, and before we had any artwork or anything, we just pitched the concept of what Dr. Dude was. And we got done, and Steve Kordick sat at the other end of the conference table, and he said, "I don't know what the hell you guys are talking about, but go ahead. It sounds good to me." So, anyway, next slide. And then the party continued. We took the party out to the party zone. It's sitting right here today. So it's nice to see it here again. And we you know, between Elvira and the party monsters and the dudes that were created from Dr. Dude, they all got together and created a party out in the party zone.
Party animal guys.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's, I don't know, we're not like huge partiers, but for some reason we just kept coming up with these party theme games. And actually, I did have some pretty awesome parties when I was young, so I guess I did enjoy entertaining people to some degree. Anyway, we'll go to the next slide. And then our last effort together was Scared Stiff, and I feel one of our best games together. We took the Elvira theme. Engineering did not want us to do another Elvira game, but we had another Elvira game in us. And since we switched to Dot Matrix and we had better sound system, we felt like we could enhance the experience from the first game and take it in a different direction too, you know, to some degree. So it was great working on this. Unfortunately, this is another point in the history of pinball where we were laying people off, and Mr. Norman got the axe nearing the end of the project, and it was tough times for all of us, the people that got left behind, the people that lost their jobs. Just another dark day. One of the videotapes laying on the bed is Black Thursday, I think. So that was the day of the axe. The axe came down. So anyway, moving on. We get to the whiz bang pinball period. So let's go to the next one. In 2009, he and I reunited. We had seen each other one time in 2006. Previous to that, but we hadn't really worked or talked to each other for all that time. So in 2009, we found ourselves in a similar underemployed situation, should I say, and we were both guests at the Northwest Pinball Show in Seattle. So next slide. We kept hearing people talk about custom games, and a lot of people had brought custom pinball games to that show with custom artwork. And so I started thinking, well, wait a minute, this is cool, you know. I'm an artist, he's a designer, we should think about this. So we go to the next slide. We had breakfast before we left for the airport. We had breakfast. We parked our Woody out in front of the... it's not our Woody. Out in front of the Mecca Cafe, and next slide, we had a delicious, nutritious breakfast in this, you know, cool place. I mean, the Mecca Cafe, if you go to Seattle, you got to go there. Anyway, so I told Dennis, I have an idea, and I want to share it with you. So you want to hit that? Yeah, there it is. Sorry. But anyway... you know, I work on this stuff late at night, and I go, oh, I could do this, and I do it. So anyway, so he thought it was a good idea, I think, by the, you know, look on his face. the night before, you know, here's the other bad joke coming, right? The night before, I was so excited by this custom idea. It was keeping me up all night. And so I was sleepless in Seattle. Anyway, we flew home really fast because after we put these ideas together, it was like, oh, we're on the plane writing down ideas as we're flying home. And so we got back home, and we were able to form a company. We didn't do that first, really, but you know, my wife was like, you better form a company. And I, okay, we'll do that. So we got that going, and then we had a flashback. So it's important to have flashbacks in life because you learn a lot from your past and you bring it forward and stuff. So the flashback goes to Southern Illinois at a museum, a really great art museum, like real art. Not just like some country store art, but it had like real artists, you know, in there, and they had a pinball show there with our artwork. Some of us participated, and pinball machines, and it was very cool. So Dennis and I met there in 2006, and we hadn't seen each other since the Elvira debacle when he got laid off. So we meet at this show, and we start seeing games from the past, you know. So next slide. We see this game, and I didn't think anything of it, but he thought a lot about it.
Well, right? I just thought the cabinet was cool. I hadn't seen a cabinet like that before, and I just thought the cabinet was cool, so I wanted to buy it. So I bought it, and the guy delivered it to my office at Stern, and he opened the trailer door, and the back glass was cracked in half. And that's not a game you can get another back glass for. I found out later that it's not much fun to play anyway, so it was no. So I stored it in my shop for a couple years, just folded up and stuck in the back corner.
It sat there from 2006 till 2009 when he said, "Well, I got an old EM game we can probably start with." So that's what we did. We took this concept of chopping, so to speak, an old wood rail EM game and turning it into something completely different.
And the reason we chose an EM game is because we had no money, so we couldn't afford a hardware system. We couldn't afford a programmer or a sound designer. So we thought we were just going to make a one-off art project. And so,
basically.
Yeah.
Next slide. So that's the original play field. So you can see that, Dennis, if you've played the game already or haven't played it, pay attention because this game had three gobble holes down the center. It was a mean game. But back then, games could be meaner because they were the only game in town. So, but you can see at the bottom the similarity with the 2-inch flippers and the posts and the 10-point scoring. That's about, you know, where it stops. That is, of course, the bullseye targets. But that's the starting point that we started with, and then Dennis, took that further. So let's go to the next slide. We didn't know anything about EM games, so we called our local Team EM representative, Ken Walker, and he taught us a lot, and he got that game running really quickly. So that was cool. That was an important step. Here's a cool picture from inside the cabinet where it's got, like, the date handwritten on there by a person that inspected it. I thought that was cool. Next one. So here's the pitch. So after we get that game running, I get a call from Dennis, and he's like, "You got to come out to my house. I got to pitch this idea to you." I said, "Cool. All right, let's go." So I show up, and he says, "Okay, so we both love Fruit Crate labels. You know, it's like they're a thing of beauty from the past. They're just you know, iconic, and you know, it was a big part of American advertising at one point in time. And they are. This is a nice composite of everything together." Oh, that's all right. And then secondly, we both love the history of pinball art. And pinup art as well. So we figured, hey, this is really, really cool to like take, you know, combine the two. You know, Dennis said, you know, let's take those two ideas and put them together as a mashup. And so we'll go to the next one here. And you know, using my art skills and Dennis's
management skills.
Management skills. I like that. I was going to say hammer skills. We put together, you know, this was the pitch. He said it's going to be about a game about melons and farming. And so the original name was not Big Juicy Melons. It was Sweet Juicy Melons. But we figured, hey, in advertising, big is better, right? So we went with big. Anyway, next slide. This was the original sketch that Dennis showed me. And it was like hands down. Oh, yeah, that's the cabinet? Of course it is. That's awesome.
See how risque those early fruit crate labels were?
Yeah, we picked up on that a little bit. But yeah. Not too bad. Anyway, next slide. So I started on sketches. Everything starts from scratch. So I started on sketches while he was working on the cabinet design. Next slide. This is to show the garage phase of our work. So we had to Dennis stripped down the original finish, also cut the cabinet so that it was a square instead of raked like a standard pinball cabinet, so it would look like a fruit crate when we were done. So these are early photographs of the work in progress cabinet. The base crate was starting to take shape. And to weather the wood was a project unto itself, right?
Yeah, I made a little brass wire thing with all kinds of nuts and washers, and then took the wood trim out because we wanted it to look like old, ancient, beat up fruit crates. And I just beat on the wood and nicked it all up, and then I hit it with a torch, and then I wire brushed it, I stomped on it in the gravel, and took out all my frustrations, and so that's how the wood trim started. And some of it's gray. Well, you'll see pictures later, but Just to keep me from getting too bored by doing the same thing over and over for four games, some of the cabinets are brown, some are gray, some are different colors.
Go to the next slide. So yeah, that's you know, starting to shape up, showing the base crate in progress.
What are you laughing at?
All right. Next slide. You know, here's the biggest thing. We brought this to Pinball Expo in 2009 as just a concept, you know, and people kept looking at the cabinet on top of the base crate, and they go, well, when are you going to put the legs on? And we said, well, that's kind of the point here. It just sits there on the crate, and it doesn't need legs. But it seemed like the pinball players really, really need to have legs on a game, but we've hopefully proven that wrong now. Anyway, next one. So there's starting to shape up where we're getting the cabinet put on. The 2x4 came to life here when we needed to rake that angle just right for the game. And later, the crushed cans became part of the design legend that goes with this.
For fine-tuning of the proper play field
position. You know, position. He was all proud when he showed me the 2x4. He goes, isn't that cool? The farmer just kind of put a 2x4 in there. I go, yeah, but wouldn't it be cooler if to get just the right angle, he had to squeeze a beer can under there? And it's like, so that was, we have fun designing. We hope that translates to fun when you play it. So
the cabinet is actually bolted to the crate, but it's bolted using rubber biscuits so that you can still shake the main cabinet.
Yep. Next slide.
And then there's leg levelers on the base crate.
That's me when I was skinnier. Next slide. So that's, here's another Continental Cafe that somebody thought looked better in pink. So, and we lovingly referred to her as Pinky.
I drove to Minnesota to pick that up.
Yeah. So, you know, we needed more because we figured, okay, we're not just going to make one. Let's make a couple. So we ended up building four in his garage. The first one remained all the original guts for the EM version. And the other three became a solid-state version that we built through the help of Carrie Imming from Minnesota. And this is really the part where we needed help because we could not have gotten through this without our friends. Ken Walker and Mark Wayna came to our rescue, and I kept asking them, so about how much time do you think this is going to take? And they'd be like, well, you know, could take a lot of time. So It's like, okay, but like, you know, as a businessman, I'm trying to wrap this up and trying to figure out like how many hours it's worth, you know. And they're like, oh, I don't know. So anyway, we never got a straight answer, and then the rest was history. It took quite a while.
3 years later.
Yeah, part time though. They weren't working on it full time like we were working on it part time as well. Next slide, please. So here's Dennis's first pass of the playfield layout on the left. And then after discussing it with guys like Mark Wayna and Ken Walker, it got refined. So as you can see, well, you want to talk about that.
So my first idea on the left, the first thing I wanted to do was add return lanes so that the player had more control and could actually make shots in the game. So this is the first wood rail style game that had return lanes on both flippers. And I eliminated two of the gobble holes. I kept the two melon targets because I think they're pretty cool. They're targets on the outside but a little pin in the inside for higher scoring. And so I kept everything like all spread out and very symmetrical, just like the old games. And then Mark Wayna was talking to me. And since we played the EM, didn't have a lot of power, and I didn't think or didn't realize that putting pop bumpers close together that you might get a lot of cool action out of it. And Mark convinced me, no, I think you can. So I stacked all the pop bumpers together in the center there, all four of them, and put the four lanes at the top, and then a shot back to the top where those two 10 point rollovers are. So it's got a shot back to the top and it's got return lanes, so you can make a lot of shots on this game.
This is where it started to bridge between the old and the new, you know. So the return lanes and the shot back to the top were key to get this game to feel more modern. Next slide. And this is just a shot of, you know, I have so many shots of just people working. It's great. You know, we got a lot of help on this. This is where we started seeing the art package come together with, you know, a red background, blue background. Hey, family, what do you think? You know, everybody's voting on it. And so the blue ended up winning, I think. But, you know, those are part of the choices in the design process, you know, that you make. We got first flipping whitewood up to Milwaukee in 2010. And, you know, it was exciting to see it played by other people instead of just in the garage. So, and you get a lot of good feedback. Roger Sharp, next slide, I think those are Roger's hands, recommended another rollover switch for the left side so that when you shot to the, like, what would be left orbit with the right flipper, you'd find a place to get up to the jet bumpers and have an opportunity of scoring again on a rollover switch. So that was key. I'm sorry. Can you go back one? My hand got out of control. So that guy that's facing us is Kerry Imming, and he's the guy that was instrumental in getting it from EM to a solid state through a system that he designed called PinKit. And more people are kind of, you know, going in that direction, but it's modular based. It's much like Spike, and it got us to where we needed to be to build three more games quickly. So he was key in that.
And that really lit a spark under my fire, because all of a sudden the game started playing fast like a modern game, and very fast and snappy. And so then we realized, hey, we've got something pretty different and cool here.
All right, let's move on. We're running out of time. There's Roger having a good time, throwing his two cents in. Go to the next one. So that's it. That was the project at that point. So now we take it to the next level. We go to Stern, and we have to convince Stern that this is a good thing. Can we go to the next slide? Next one. So convincing Gary wasn't too much of a problem. He really liked the game when he first saw it, and thought maybe this is a risk that we could take. So we're appreciative that Gary had the vision to take this to the next level. Let's move on. This is one of our buyers of the original four games, and the key here was that these guys that bought the four games, we before we even went to Stern, we said, if we take this to a bigger audience, are you guys okay with that? Because you're spending hard-earned money on four games that, you know, are part of a beginning, but do you, are you okay with us taking this further? And all four of them, you know, we got thumbs up from everybody on that. And we're, again, couldn't be more appreciative of the fact that they said yes. So we'll move on. Tom Copera, instrumental in getting the mechanical design from what we created to what Stern could now mass produce in the factory.
And he designed the knockdown crate
base. Yep, that was one of his goals. Was to be able to fit everything in a standard Stern box. So the base crate had to become a knockdown IKEA-style piece of furniture to put the game on. First guy to touch the project was John Trudeau. He had just gotten a Stern, and he took the DXF drawing,
my AutoCAD.
AutoCAD drawing, and turned it into a SolidWorks, because everything Stern does is SolidWorks. That's the first whitewood at Stern with the usual size flippers. The trick here was getting the wood, the finish that he built in his shop, to come through in the finished product. So that's that was a trick that we needed to go to. This is the first stealth cabinet that came in. We didn't want anybody to know what we were working on, so they painted it black.
No, that's the only color that Churchill has, I think.
Yeah, that could be. So anyway, next one. This is starting to take shape. We start fitting the play field. The bottom arch is retooled. We got Spike in the – well, this is before they installed Spike, so I just put a picture of Spike up in the back box. Next one. These are people, again, behind-the-scenes people that, you know, we come here and we get to talk about the games that we make, but these people, you know, are instrumental in getting everything to the line and making sure everything is right. If you've had any trouble with games, you've talked to Pat Powers, I'm sure. We got Dave Coudeau that builds up our first whitewoods. Reina Cortez does an amazing job with our wiring harnesses. She designs them all. And Paul Mandeltort is here today, but he's no longer with Stern. He moved on. But he's a great guy, and as well as the Marco people that support the Stern product. Next one. We had to make modifications to the size of the back glass. We start getting pieces in from the vendors, and everything's starting to come to life. Every time we do a back glass, it gets press proofed, and we have to do a press check to make sure the colors are right. And I'm really happy with the printing of this back glass. It's really rich. It's double hit with two layers of color, so I'm really happy with that. Next one. We had to really tweak the eject hole, to get that to sit right. So that took about 4 or 5 hours of playing that shot over and over to get it just right. These are wood samples from the vendor in North Carolina that sent us how the weathering wood might look. So we approved that, and the next day, Stern woke up with wood. So and a lot of it. So that's the load that came in for all the trim on the game. And unfortunately, they sent it to Stern, not to our cabinet company. So we had to resend that to them, which is a pain. Anyway, next one. So it's at Churchill Cabinets. They make our games every day, and so this was completely different for them. So we start working with Churchill, and for them it was outside the box, right? Really. It was hard for them to see how this was going to shape up, but we got things going. We got the stain going. Everything's coming together nicely. Unfortunately, the first six games were a different color. They swapped the colors differently, but that's okay. Those six games will forever be unique. Next one. We've got, we spent a lot of time with them to make sure that this was going to be the best thing it could be. Next one. We're just keep going.
Brad Grant was the first guy to build his own Wonelli from a back glass and playfield, printed playfield. There's a few more people out there. We heard yesterday that somebody else from here is building their own game. So kudos to them for taking that on. These are our three games as we got near the finish line. Back then, we did an outdoor photo shoot in the middle of November. So she had fun, not really, but we got that accomplished. So that's our poster. This is at the Stern Shop showing the game as it comes together on the line. Next one. And, you know, thumbs up to the playfield printing. Next one. Keep going. Just trying to move on because I found out we don't have much time left. This is us on the line. This is Bigfoot showed up to give his stamp of approval. Don Thorne runs our whole factory line. Wanted to give him a shout out because he does a lot of work for the company. Al Dale is our operations manager. Great guy. Really makes sure that everything's getting done. This is you know, a couple of guys just trying to figure out how to get that base crate figured out. So we've been to Texas now. We've been to Milwaukee, and we're getting people on our side. It's like people didn't know what this game was about, you know. Todd, I love that picture. We were all standing in that picture. Nobody was crouching to take that picture. That's Todd McCullough from Seattle. So we're winning more fans of Wonelli because once you play it, once you experience it, It's a pretty unique project. So next one, it's yeah. You can use the crate for other, you know, hide things. I love this picture because it's just a throwback to, you know, production line, and there it is, the reels, you know. So love it. Next one, harvesting play fields. Next one, this is the end of Melrose Park. So we're finishing up Wonelli's there. That's Melrose Park, almost on the last day. So there's the last game at Melrose, literally. Last game at Melrose, April 30th. First cabinets come to Elk Grove. Start to see everything come together. First play fields, next one. Sorry, I'm rushing. Jack Benson, great guy. New programmer for Stern. He's doing a great job. And he knows we're old, and we know he's young, so it works pretty well together. Next one. Barty is our quality control person out on the line. She does a great job. So we'll move on. Steve Martin does a lot of behind-the-scenes artwork for me. He's now a full-time employee, and we have fun together. We drink on the job. No, we don't. This is Jerry Thompson. He's responsible for the music and the sounds in the game. He did a great job. Jessica Rowe, Jerry found Jessica. She's a perfect voice for the game, we think. Next one. And Rod Olson voiced the crazy guy, and we couldn't have picked a better of talent for this guy. He did a great job. This is to show you how the base crate looks without the game on top of it, and that shows the actual engine mounts that it mounts to. And it does have leg levelers, so we wanted to point that out because a lot of people don't understand that you can level the game with the leg levelers, just like a standard setup. And the 4 degrees pitch, now we recommend higher than that, probably 5.5 to 6. 4 degrees if you want an EM experience. Next one, we're almost done. Game operations, Attaball having great success with the game in Seattle. And the games are available now, so, you know, step right up. We want to get these out in the field. Next one, and, you know, talk to Marco, talk to your local distributor. It's all good. And one more. The kit. So if you happen to end up with the first 70, one of 74 games, they did not ship the leg replacements on. We can talk about that later, but and you'll get a beer can that's not crushed. So anyway, how are we doing? I think we're done.
Fantastic.
All right.
Thank you.
So, guys, great work. This is spectacular. If you haven't played this game out in the main ballroom next to the Marco's booth, go play it. It's really, really a unique experience. Now, Dennis and Greg are going to be escorted by my helper, Brian Caudell, here to the signing area. I would ask that you guys not try and grab them on the way there. Please wait till they get to the signing area. That just helps with our flow. And I want to put in a plug. Tomorrow, 11 to 12, there's going to be another session with these guys where there's no slideshow for that session. It's just going to be fireside chat. They'll be here to talk about probably anything you guys want and take some questions, what have you. And then near the end of that session, there's going to be the drawing for those of you who brought games to the show for this party zone back here. And Dennis and Greg will sign it when and wherever you want. And so be here for that. That drawing, that's going to be very exciting. So with that, let's give these guys a hand one more time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.